This is the International Anthony Burgess Foundation podcast. Anthony Burgess was one of the most important and prolific British writers of the 20th century. Most famous for his dystopian vision, A Clockwork Orange, he wrote 33 novels, 25 books of non-fiction, and over 250 musical compositions. This podcast aims to illuminate Burgess's life and work, and his connections to other 20th century literature, film, and music. So join us as we explore the world of Anthony Burgess. In this episode, Andrew Biswell speaks to writer and journalist Andy Spinoza about his new book, Manchester Unspun, a cultural history of Anthony Burgess's hometown. Andy Spinoza moved from London to Manchester at the age of 18 and has remained in the city ever since. He wrote about Manchester's music scene for the NME and The Face, and he founded the alternative magazine City Life in 1983, which charted the city's cultural life for over 20 years and helped launch the careers of Mark Kermode, John Ronson and Melvin Burgess, among others. Andy also worked as a gossip columnist for Manchester Evening News for 10 years, during which time he met Anthony Burgess several times. Andy's latest book, Manchester Unspun, details the post-industrial boom of Manchester from the 1970s to the present, and is published by Manchester University Press. It's available now from your favourite place to buy books. Head to the description of this episode for all the relevant links. Here's Andrew Biswell, who spoke to Andy Spinoza at the Burgess Foundation in central Manchester in February 2023.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Andy Spinoza, author of Manchester Unspun, writer, journalist, now autobiographer. You came to Manchester as a student in 1979. Tell us, first of all, what kind of a place was it then?
Well, I arrived to a city centre, and I had a city centre student residence as well, so I was very much tied, if you like, locationally to the area around Piccadilly Station, and everywhere you could was in walking distance from there, including the university. And you know, apart from the route to university, in any direction out of the centre was dereliction and decay. And, you know, there was a feel of a ruined empire. You know, not a vacant ruined empire during the day, because commerce went on, there were shops and people hustling, bustling around. But it was, you know, it was grimy, it was grubby. And particularly on a Sunday when, as a student, my friends and I would explore a very vacant centre, because older readers will know Sunday closing was a thing, shops didn't open. You know, we would walk through the ruins, and very evocative in a Gothic grandeur way it was too, especially Manchester Central, which is now an exhibition centre, called Manchester Central, was then Manchester Central Station, or it had been. Station closed in the late 50s, and you could wander in there and wander down the canal all the way to through Salford out along the Manchester Ship Canal, and it was it made an impression, let's put it that way.
And tell us about setting up City Life magazine. You and your, I think, friends from university decided to get going with this publication. How did that come about, and what was it like in the early days, the magazine?
Yeah, I think first of all, we have to remember that it was what was termed an alternative magazine, just like alternative comedians and alternative lifestyle health food shops. There was a mainstream, there was a kind of an established media, and there were not very many alternatives. Today, everyone can publish online and everyone's got a blog. And so you don't hear that phrase anymore, do you? Alternative media. But we did set up as a workers' cooperative. Three of us joined soon by maybe two or three or four other people as we grew. And a listings magazine based on the very familiar Time Out model in London. But also we had a dirt digging kind of private eye magazine style approach to Manchester politics and the life of the city. And early days, very hand to mouth. We were student journalists from, so we had experience at the newspaper, at the Manchester University Students Union, but we were taking on a lot, and city life should have closed financially many times, but we somehow pulled it through, never missed an issue, and worked all the hours available, and was a sort of a classic survival, but also lifestyle thing. We enjoyed, you know, going to the art galleries, the music shows, the book launches, everything culturally that we were interested in made the life of the city we were able to access for free. And we also gave opportunity for relatively famous people nowadays, people like Mark Kermode, film critic, John Ronson, the author and broadcaster, and many others who had the first scribblings for our alternative magazine.
You'd started off as a student journalist just before City Life, and you write in the book about your first encounter with Tony Wilson, I think in a Fabian Society meeting in Moon Grove. Mm. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, I was I came to Manchester obsessed really with music, and not only music, but that kind of mediated experience of it through new music press, what TV programmes there were, radio, mainly music press. And obviously Tony Wilson was a huge, a giant of that kind of alternative music scene. And I was hanging around in the student union on Oxford Road one day, and I saw this very neatly written sign, Fabian Society meeting, Tony Wilson in conversation with Gerald Corfman MP, and the title was something about the role of the media in today's society. And I persuaded a friend to come with me. I said, let's go and interview him. So I had that kind of journalist, I had some kind of drive and ambition, I suppose. And we found the address, very curious. Moon Grove is a beautifully preserved early Victorian street. It was once the home of, no doubt, affluent people back in the early 19th century. And we thought the meeting would be in kind of a community hall. It was someone's living room, basically. And we went in, we heard Corfman and Wilson debate matters of the day, and all good knockabout stuff. And then afterwards, I plucked up the courage to ask Wilson for an interview, and he more than happily agreed. And he said, yeah, I've got 10 minutes, let's have a chat. And chatted about this and that, and Ian Curtis's recent death. And I was recording all this on an old Philips mono recorder, which afterwards I played back, and alas, I had placed the microphone on top of the machine. All I could hear was this kind of sound sculpture of the machines whirring away, completely obliterating Wilson's voice. I could just barely hear his voice. I couldn't really make out any of the words. So, you know, what those utterances were, will never, you know, they were lost that day and will never be transcribed.
So you have a go at reconstructing them in the book, which is very entertaining.
Yeah, my memory, he made an impression, and he argued with Corfman about how IRA terrorists, as are reported in the mainstream news, should be reported. He basically said, and sometimes he grandstanded, and you've got to take this with a pinch of salt. He said when he wrote his bulletins, he would describe IRA atrocities, and he would call them IRA It was either soldiers or freedom fighters. Obviously, this outrage, and the editors at Granada would change it back to terrorists. So this would outrage Kaufman. There was a good old ding dong around that. And yeah, I've been able to paraphrase in the book. The reader will have to trust me that I've got a reasonable grasp of that, of those words.
One of the provocative ideas in the book, I think, which I've not really come across elsewhere, or not expressed in quite this way, is the idea of the North-South divide within Manchester, which is to say that, for example, editors of the Manchester Evening News, council leaders, always had to come from North Manchester. And I wonder what are the differences for people who don't know the city, and how far do they still hold, do you think?
Yeah, something that I worked at Manchester Evening News very deeply as a freelance 5 years, followed by 5 years as staff. So in the book, I'm able to describe the culture there, which, you know, it was the nation's biggest selling, you know, daily newspaper for many, many years, big city newspaper. And city, it reflected, it saw as a very gritty working class conurbation, which South Manchester, editors felt, did not really have that same authenticity. That there were more London types in the south of the city, in those suburbs of Didsbury, Withington, Falaford, a lot of students, and that they felt the real Manchester was, not only in Manchester as a city, but neighbouring Salford, Bolton, Bury, Rochdale, even out to Warrington, where the paper went. And the paper was even sold in Blackpool. And that there was a mindset, less liberal, perhaps less tolerant, more straight-talking, and perhaps, you know, while Labour voting still conservative with a small C in social attitudes, and they felt that was the heartland and the soul of the real Manchester. So South Manchester was viewed suspiciously. And I think to a certain degree, that duality still exists in Greater Manchester. However, you know, Manchester Evening News is a different animal. It's mainly online these days. And Manchester is very different. You know, there are interesting migrant communities in parts of North Manchester. Used to be exclusively, you know, traditionally, white working class. I think that's interesting, you know, from a social and cultural point of view. And at the end of the book, I talked to a guy called Michael Adex, who's of African origin, who set up a record company called NQ in North Manchester. The reason I spoke to him is I thought it was interesting that he'd actually bought a building and invested in the city, in North Manchester, traditional part of Manchester, where, you know, Bernard Manning, the offensive racist comedian, was the mainstay of local entertainment. So I think things are changing, but it's undoubtedly the case that the southern half of the city, which borders more affluent Cheshire County, is without doubt the more affluent of the two halves of North and South Manchester, Greater Manchester.
Mm. You also described a meeting, I think an interview with Bernard Manning, as part of your beat. Was this at the MEN?
No, City Life.
City Life.
Yeah. I knew that City Life's readership would have hated and detested Bernard Manning, because we were everything that quote, right on, liberal, left-leaning magazine should be. However, I think I wrote that, you know, he was a phenomenon to be analysed, not ignored, and I thought it'd be very interesting to meet him and have that discussion. I think I tease out, 30-odd years later, I tease out, I think, in the book, attitudes that I think probably could be quite clearly seen as the kind of attitudes that led to the Brexit vote. In working class communities that felt they weren't getting a fair deal, easy to exploit with extreme racial prejudice. And I wanted to get inside his mindset, and I think I got some interesting quotes. You know, I think he says at one point, you know, we won the war and Japan and Germany are doing better than us economically. You know, where's the benefit, you know, where's the dividend for the people around here? And I think, you know, it's a view that, as I say, I think is probably in a continuum of sentiment that has led to the what's called the Red Wall, you know, collapse of Labour seats and the and what's happened with Brexit. Because I could see Bernard Manning and his staff, and I went a couple of times, these were Labour voters, but to all intents and purposes, they were sort of, they had racialist opinions, a lot of them laughed at racist jokes, and had a lot of social attitudes that your North London Labour elite would have hated.
One of the other characters who comes into your story is James Anderton, who, at one time was very well known. He was sort of nationally famous or notorious. He's the former chief constable of Greater Manchester, recently deceased. So at this point, we can say what we like without fear of libel.
Sure.
But I was very interested to learn from your book that Anderton's very strongly, essentially kind of anti-gay opinions were defended in the Manchester Evening News. And that came, I was astonished by that, actually.
Well, I think that makes my point that he was from Wigan originally. His beat was in Moss Side as a bobby. I once got in a lift with James Anderton at a business event. I was there for the Evening News, and he was a giant of a man, about 6'4", very, very sturdily built, with a great big black beard. And we know he saw himself as some kind of Old Testament prophet. He was lampooned at the time for that. But he was the living embodiment of that Manchester Evening News perception of what a strong working class leader, if you like, should be, with all those with all the attitudes that went with it.
It's pleasing as well to see some of the kind of less well-known Manchester characters coming up in your pages. For example, Bob Dickinson, writer, radio producer, also C.P. Lee, who's very badly missed, and Chris Seavey, better known, I suppose, to most people as Frank Sidebottom. How old did you know Chris Seavey in particular?
Okay, so the Chris Seavey aspects of my story will probably surprise and, if not upset, people who thought of him as a lovable kind of scamp, which, you know, his surreal comedy, the man behind Frank Sidebottom, the papier mâché headed character who was like a cartoon character. He worked with the likes of Chris Evans, who became famous radio and TV personality, Mark Radcliffe, the radio DJ, Carolina Hearn, the famous comedian who died tragically early. And Chris Seavey, to me, was a guy who was pretty embittered that he had worked with all these people who had gone on to great success, but hadn't happened for him. And through me, he attempted to sell all kinds of stories about his former colleagues and friends to national newspapers, including the story that he believed Caroline Hearn had stolen the Mrs. Merton character from him when he'd asked her to perform a role in some comedy skit on the radio. So, you know, there was another side to him, and it's an interesting tale which I describe in full. Yeah.
There's a Burgess link there, I'm happy to say, in that one of the last things he did was he played the character Enderby in a performance for the Manchester Literature Festival. So we got to know him, I mean, very slightly for a very short time. But Anthony Burgess, here we are, we're in Burgess Foundation, we're sitting next to his head, not his actual head, I should point out, but a sculpture of his head. And he too came, you know, as part of your beat when you were doing the diary for the Manchester Evening News. Tell us about meeting Burgess.
Well, I met, I think I met Burgess three times, but two of those occasions I had my notebook in hand because I would have been covering some event or other. I was the young guy they sent to all the papers sent to all the evening do's, and there is a photo in the book of that was snapped by an evening news photographer of Burgess and I in conversation. We're both wearing black tie. I think my tie is a bit more skewed with than his, but it looks like we've both had a couple of drinks and debating something in earnest. I think he was just telling me probably his pride at winning possibly the Portico Prize. I think that was around the time the Manchester Library Prize for Literature that's held annually, about one of the times he came up. But on both occasions I met him and he was introduced to me. It's not like he didn't remember me the second time, the first time, because he said, Spinoza, sort of declaiming my surname. It was said that he was drunk on God. And he was quoting someone about the philosopher Spinoza. So, you know, that really happened in my world that someone associated my name with my namesake, of the famous philosopher Spinoza. And it was always a very nice way of easing into the conversation. So I don't have any real memory of what we discussed. Obviously, I probably took down a quote or two which made the newspaper the next day. But those articles will be somewhere in Manchester Central Library. But it was very easy to talk to, very engaging, made the conversation easy for the journalist. And I know he also came up, would see him at one or two events with Tony Wilson at the time. Wilson did a documentary, a celebration, it was called Celebration Documentary Series that Granada TV made, and he was featured in a 1 hour sort of interview. And of course, Tony Wilson's name being Anthony Wilson, and Burgess's real name is, I believe, Anthony Wilson. Is that correct?
John Anthony Burgess Wilson.
Okay, but there was a bit of badinage that the pair had about similarity of their names.
Music is very important to the story that you're recounting in this book, and you say at one point that the urban landscape of Manchester has been shaped by the music, and I was very struck by that, and I thought, is that a metaphor, or is that simply the case? But obviously, it's an important part, the Hacienda, Factory Records, within the sort of cultural history that you're describing.
I think it's more of a circular relationship. I think Stephen Morris from New Order said, people, Joy Division drummer, people used to say to him, your music sounds like Manchester, which, you know, how can that be true? But it did, you know. I think what I try and tease out is that the Hacienda was the first regeneration project, if we can look at it that way, of the dying city centre. In fact, it gave a kiss of life to the dying city centre of Manchester. And in its very purpose, it was about the recreation of the city. And on the membership form for the original, for the first members of the Hacienda, had a membership form which stated intention to restore a sense of place. I mean, these people were putting their own money up. There were no public sector grants applied for. know, Arts Council forms were filled in. It was their money, and out of civic pride, they wanted to build what Wilson grandly called a cathedral for popular culture. And I think the notion of the rebirth of a city is embedded in the whole idea of the Hacienda. The Hacienda inspired a whole range of people to come into the city and also put their own money up, make things happen. So the woman credited with kickstarting the gay village, Carol Ainsco, who put up the Manto Bar, which was very similar in design values to the Hacienda, credited Tony Wilson and everything that he did as the reason that she did it. Urban Splash, the residential property firm, cite Wilson and Hacienda as their inspiration. There were a whole range of things that Hacienda kicked off. And I think more than that, music culture and the design values of, if you like, the factory Hacienda art project created a global interest in Manchester that no council could hope to achieve with brochures and adverts and conferences and in traditional ways of raising interest around the world to say there's something interesting going on here, and the kind of people who are interested in that kind of art are artists, influential media people, but also business people. I think, you know, it's not a stretch to say that those early flowerings of Manchester celebrating itself, which is what the Hacienda was, it was Manchester celebrating itself, no care for what London was doing. And also, sounds parochial, doesn't it? But its design values gave Hacienda and Factory an international feel, which was so unique at the time. That has informed and influenced what has happened in the city centre over the last 40 years.
John Ryder was on the telly the other night saying that nobody ever went to the Hacienda. Whenever he went there, it was always completely empty. But I don't know how much truth there is in that. Maybe the question here is, why did it fail, given that those very lofty aspirations? But clearly there are various reasons. Tell us.
Yeah, the Hacienda was open for 15 years, and it went through different phases. It was obviously reflected the music and fashion scenes of the time. So it did open after the early Factory nights in Hume, in a busman's social club in Hume in the late 70s. Didn't last long, but they got the idea to do something much more, much grander, and much more stable in a bigger place on Whitman Street West. That was 1982. He said it was a cathedral for popular culture, but it only attracted tiny congregation, you know, and a lot of gigs did okay, and some nights were very, very busy, but basically it was losing money. It continued to rely on New Order to do basically benefit gigs to keep it going. I mean, they were co-owners. Only when the rave scene took off in the late 80s, it was like the gods of pop culture had smiled on the Hacienda. Suddenly there was this space that took 1,200, probably 1,500 people, and the crowd was the show. The people became the party. The music was different. Tony Wilson didn't really see it coming, didn't really see dance music. It was all about bands for him. So it kind of took him by surprise, but people running the club knew what was going on. And for maybe 18 months, it was like a secret society there, until the drug that fueled that scene, which was ecstasy, became a magnet for gun-toting gangs, and there was a death in there of a young girl. taking a rogue tablet, and the whole thing turned very, very sour. You know, then what happened? This is what I think is really crucial to my theory of why the Hacienda was so influential. The police wanted to close the club in the early 90s, and the council turned around and said to the police and the magistrates, they wrote letters, we need this club open. This is what the new economy of Manchester is all about, culture and tourism. They got the MP, Bob Liverland, to write a letter to the police and the magistrates. You know, in what city of the world would the local authorities try and keep a place open that had become a carnival of crime? You know, and they knew that this was a special source that Manchester had. This was where the Manchester homegrown authentic youth culture was coming out. I mean, don't get me wrong, there were other clubs, there were other places. The whole city was, was, I think, seeing itself as a music city. And people came from all over the world to see the nightlife. And it stayed open until 1997. And by that time, music had moved on and the numbers were low. And, you know, basically admittedly, the club's accountants, KPMG, forced the building to be shuttered because it was trading insolvently, basically. You know, that all, you know, came to an end. I think both youth cultures go in cycles. They have peaks and endings, and that was why the Hacienda had to close.
You describe a city in the 1980s and into the 90s, which, from your account of it, really seems to have had a kind of cultural centre, in the sense that there were places where people went, or many of your friends and associates went, like the Press Club, and there are particular bars and restaurants. And you got me wondering whether that still exists in this kind of strangely post-lockdown world where everyone's kind of phoning it in or working from home. Does the city have a centre now, do you think? And if it does, where is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, because the centre, just spatially, it's probably doubled in size, you know, even in the past 20 years. The Manchester I knew as a 20s, in my 20s and 30s, you could, you know, as a gossip columnist, you know, if I covered off phone calls to Midland Hotel, Granada TV, owned hotel, Victoria and Albert, and some of the restaurants and bars, you know, I knew that's where anyone remotely famous or important would have been. You know, the city centre itself, what people think of it is probably, it's got new areas like Ancoats, Castlefields, Spinning Fields, and the adjoining Enterprise City where the Factory International is going to be. So has it got a centre? I think that probably Manchester is becoming like all large cities, urban centres, where there are neighbourhoods now, specific neighbourhoods where people probably spend a lot of their time because they have shops and bars and facilities close to where they live. And of course, that's been the massive transformation in the numbers. You know, when I came to Manchester in 79, only a few hundred people lived in the city centre. Probably a lot of them were caretakers looking after business premises. And I had some research done for this book. There's probably 75,000 people now living in that same area, many of them in towers over 20 stories high. And that in itself gives tower living, gives a very different character to city centre living. A lot of them have got such great facilities that you wonder how much people are going into the ground floor and walking the streets. So, you know, it's very difficult to locate a centre, I think, these days.
It's a big question here, which is maybe an impossible one, but what do you think are the most significant changes you've witnessed since 1979 in Manchester?
I mean, the main change has been sheer numbers. People living in the centre, but the style of life that they're living, which is really for youngish people, for people under the age of 40. I mean, there are some grey-haired residents and people with young children, but generally it's an incredibly young urban population living, you know, living a life of culture and bars and lifestyle that, you know, that is not seen in the suburbs. I think it's unusual among British cities in that you have to accept London, take it out of the comparison, because London's a world city. You can't compare it to Manchester. But a lot of the cities that Manchester were equivalents of in the late 70s, early 80s, haven't had the same regeneration that Manchester has enjoyed. Many of them might have had some makeovers, but they've not got the same dynamic economy that Manchester appears to have. So I think Manchester, as a dense urban centre of economy and leisure, is the biggest, you know, the most obvious difference from those days. But the fact that so many young people are living in high towers also makes it very different to London. London, those high, yes, there are some high buildings in London and people living in them. Some of them may be former council blocks, but in the centre of London, those towers are commercial, they're offices. There's nowhere in the country, actually, where large numbers of people are living in such a dense cluster of tall towers. And in my book's research shows there are 55 towers over 20 stories in what I call the wider city centre. And that pipeline of planning, construction, in the works, that's going to double by the next by 2030. So this is a very interesting, serious social phenomenon that we're seeing here.
I have a final question about cultural identity, I guess. You've been here 44 years, so I'm sure you've had a chance to reflect on this. Is it possible for an outsider, we're both outsiders, to become a Manc?
I mean, what is a Mancunian these days? I think that's a question that I pose, not in so many words, but to the end of the book, that the sheer number of people, not only from, you know, from England, from London, but from around the world, mean that Manchester is populated by people who may have very little idea of the city's history, both ancient and modern. You know, and one of the questions I ask is, if the music of that the city's so associated with over the years, you know, let's say, not only Joy Division, New Order, but the Smiths and Oasis, this is music that you can kind of, that people, and the Fall, people pinpoint though that sound as coming from Manchester. Well, you know, if the city makes the culture, then what will the music of the new Manchester sound like? And that music will be made by people from all over the world. I mean, just round the corner from where we're talking is a very densely populated area of Asian, you know, restaurants, shops, bars, and with lots of students and research students who are from China and Hong Kong and other Far Eastern countries. And, you know, are they Mancunians? If they live here for a number of years, then you have to say, well, they are. Would traditional Mancunians recognise them as Mancunians or not? I don't know, things are in flux, you know, they're changing and they're fluid, and that's an interesting picture I think we need to keep our eye on. People sometimes refer to me as an adopted Mancunian, which is fine, and no doubt you've possibly got the same description, Andrew. But I think cities these days attract. All right, cities these days are very porous and attract people both in and out. And so all we can say, I think, is let's look at this
40 years hence and look back and see if we can describe that changing city, you know.
And I think that historical perspective, you go right back to Alexis de Tocqueville passing through Manchester in the 18th century and writing about it. That's one of the great strengths of the book. The other thing I enjoyed very much is that it's a book that smells of print, given your background in print journalism. Even the e-book smells of print, I'd have to say. It's a great book to read, Manchester Unspun, published by Manchester University Press, and wholeheartedly recommended. Andy Spinoza, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest.
You've been listening to the International Anthony Burgess Foundation podcast. Andy Spinoza's book, Manchester Unspun, is available now from Manchester University Press. For more information about Anthony Burgess and to find out how you can support the work of the Burgess Foundation, visit www.anthonyburgess.org. If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts?